you were interviewing comedians when you were in high school, much like Cameron Crowe was interviewing rock stars.
Yes.
And then made a movie about a kid interviewing rock stars. You were literally the almost famous character, but with comedians.
The difference between me and him is he wanted to interview his heroes, so he went on the road with Led Zeppelin, and I took a train to Poughkeepsie to see Weird Al Yankovic.
Hey, everybody, it's Mike Birbiglia. We are back with a new episode of Working It Out. That, of course, is the voice of Judd Apatow, the great Judd Apatow, who has a new book out. Before we begin our conversation today, I want to mention a few upcoming shows. Couldn't be more excited about my run of shows in Chicago at the Steppenwolf Theater for the month of May. I'll be performing The Old Man and the Pool. I'm doing a show at the Ace Hotel in Los Angeles on May 4th as part of the Netflix Festival. And then I'm doing a whole run of shows. I'm at the Mark Taper Forum in Los Angeles for the month of August, doing the full Old Man and the Pool with the set design and the lighting design. And it's gonna be so cool. It's like an incredible theater. Today on the show, we have Judd Apatow. Judd is a three-time returning champion to Working It Out. He's a good friend. He's given me notes on The Old Man in the Pool. And he has a new book out. It's called Sicker in the Head. It is a sequel to the hit book, Sick in the Head, Conversations About Life and Comedy. I couldn't recommend it more highly. All of the author's net proceeds are donated to 826 National, which is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing free tutoring and literacy programs. We've donated to them here on the show in the past. Judd needs no introduction. He directed me in the movie Trainwreck. He directed 40-Year-Old Virgin. He directed This Is 40. He's produced Superbad, Bridesmaids, you know, just on and on, Freaks and Geeks. It's such a great conversation. He sort of turns the tables on me and asks me a lot of questions, which may end up in the paperback version of this very book, Sicker in the Head. Get the book. It's on the bestseller list. And enjoy my conversation with the great Judd Apatow. Of all of the casts you've worked with over the years, I was in one of them. I was in Trainwreck, Freaks and Geeks and Bridesmaids and 40-Year-Old Virgin, all these movies and television shows. I mean, Undeclared. I mean, like, who's the cast who you'd love to hang with again? Like, who's the reunion cast you want to get together?
The reunion cast. I mean, I have to say, it was really fun making a movie with Sandler.
Oh my gosh, yes.
I always wanted to have that experience of directing Adam.
Yes, because you were friends, you were roommates in your 20s.
We were roommates and we did a lot of stand-up together and I tried to help him with some sketches. I was never an official writer on Saturday Night Live, but I would work on things with him. And then I did some just punch-ups on some of his movies, but I never had that full experience and I was nervous about it because I thought, does Adam listen to you? I mean, he's very successful. Can he just say no? Can halfway through the shoot, can he go, I've decided to change everything in the movie.
Oh my gosh.
Didn't know how he would handle being in the hands of someone else, even though I knew he had done that and he really enjoys
you know,
doing something with James Brooks or Paul Thomas Anderson.
Sure, Punch Drunk Love. Yeah.
And then he was just amazing, just so fun and hilarious and very prepared.
There were some
emotional scenes where he got very upset about being sick and he would just show up and he was just there. Like I didn't have to direct him. I would mold the scene a little bit, but he was always, the acting was fantastic.
He's a tremendous actor. Yeah. I mean, obviously he got a lot of awards attention for Uncut Gems, but like meanwhile, he's been making great movies for like a million years.
Well, I remember when we lived together, he had just graduated from NYU where he studied drama.
Yeah.
I mean, he took acting. And I didn't know what that even was.
Yeah.
So I'm, you know, 20 years old. And I'm like, what happens in an acting class? I didn't do any of that.
No kidding.
I was young.
Right. You were straight from the comedy club universe because your mom worked at a comedy club. And this goes back to the roots of Sicker in the Head. You were interviewing comedians when you were in high school, much like Cameron Crowe was interviewing rock stars.
Yes.
And then made a movie about a kid interviewing rock stars. You were literally the almost famous character, but with comedians.
The difference between me and him is he wanted to interview his heroes, so he went on the road with Led Zeppelin, and I took a train to Poughkeepsie to see Weird Al Yankovic, which I don't regret. It was one of the great nights of my life, and he's a great man. But his was a little cooler. He did Leonard Skinner and all of that. And we talk about it in the book, me and Cameron Crowe, this idea of loving something so much you want to get closer to it.
Oh, my gosh,
and now with the new book, really, it's about wanting to talk to people who do what you do and say to them, how are you doing? How are you holding up? How are you keeping your career going?
Yes.
Are you crazy? Do you feel sane? Are you gaining any wisdom? Like, what is your journey about? And especially doing interviews during the pandemic, people were very open to
introspection.
That.
Yeah.
Yes. And that's why for this, we thought, well, we always do a soft cover and we add four more for the soft cover, that this could be a conversation with you that would go in the soft cover version.
I just made it under the wire for the soft cover.
Well, I was just on Seth Meyers and I said, I didn't interview you for the book. And he pretended to be insulted. And I said, I could do it right now. We could start getting that ready. And then I said, what trauma made you want to go into comedy? And he went, I don't want to be in the book.
Oh, that's really
funny.
That
was the joke.
That's very funny.
And then we didn't talk about it anymore.
Yeah, I mean, interviewing comedians is pretty interesting because there's inevitably, if it's not trauma, it's definitely something extreme.
Something is happening.
Something's going on. Right? There's no natural route to comedy.
No. I mean, there's smart people. Like Seth Meyers seems like a genuinely smart person. And one of my favorite things in the Gary Shandling documentary is this moment where they're sitting on a park bench and he says, I don't understand this thing about, I'm paraphrasing, Jerry's saying about how you have to be messed up to be funny.
Oh, yeah, yeah, of course.
What about talent? Can you just be talented?
Yeah, yeah.
And then Gary goes, why are you so angry?
Yeah.
And so everyone has something. Even Jerry, I produced one of his stand-up specials.
Yeah.
There were some documentary pieces in there. And he says when he was young that his parents really left him to his own devices. They trusted him and treated him in a very adult way at a young age. And he became super self-sufficient. And if you see Jerry or talk to Jerry, he's very confident.
Yes.
He believes in all his opinions very strongly.
That's true, yeah.
And maybe that's a type of parenting that led to a way of observing the world.
That's right. And what do you think, and what do you think it is for you? What was the break that led you where you are? Which, by the way, we were joking about it before we started, but like, you're so productive, it's almost dangerous.
Yeah, there's something wrong going
on. There's something wrong. There's a brokenness. Yeah.
If during the pandemic, I make a documentary, a book, and a movie.
Yes.
In an 18-month period.
In everyone's break.
Yeah. I mean, I thought I was on a break.
Yeah.
That's the weirdest part.
Yeah.
Because I didn't even see it as a period where I was busy.
Yes.
Which is just me being crazy.
The good thing is, because I think I have a similar thing. I mean, in the pandemic, I did virtual shows and I created a podcast. I mean, it was like I did everything you could do comedy
on. I interviewed 87 people.
Yeah, exactly. But like, yeah, no, I think the thing that you and I have in common is we just need to have a pen handy to write it all down and discipline ourselves to do it a few hours a day.
And what was the moment when you were a kid where you thought comedy seems interesting and maybe a job?
When I was a kid, I would make plays at school. Like, this is how audacious I was as a kid. And this, I think, came from my mom encouraging me, which is a very positive sort of anti-trauma thing, very positive thing. She gave me the confidence to be like, I would write a play, and I'd go to the teacher and say, I'd like to perform this play. I'm in third grade. I'd like to perform this play about hamburgers.
That's Rushmore.
Yeah, it's straight out of Rushmore, yeah. And then at a certain point, you know, when I was in high school, my brother Joe took me to see Stephen Wright live at the Cape Cod Melody Tent, his first live comedy show. And for me, it was explosive, you know. It was probably similar to when your mom took you to see stand-up comedians in Long Island for the first time.
Yeah.
just couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that this person was saying these things that were so mind expanding. And
I remember the moment he did the Tonight Show because they had him on, I think, a week or two later.
Yes, that's right.
Which seemed insane.
Yes. He was that good?
Yeah.
He's that good. And so then I feel like the illusion of stand-up comedy, of course, is that you see someone who's a stand-up comedian who's great, and you go, that's exactly what I think. And you don't realize that actually it's hours and hours of the person writing and revising and writing and revising and cutting stuff to get to a point where they're making you feel that way.
Yeah. But before you realize it was stand-up, so you were young and precocious.
Yeah, it was just precocious, artist, creator kind of thing.
And smart. Was your dad a doctor?
Dad's a doctor. Mom's a nurse, yeah.
What?
Neurologist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you come from smart, I would assume, reasonably nice parents.
Smart folks. My mom is salt of the earth, like one of the kindest people. One of these, like, gives Christianity a good name kind of people, where you go like, well, she's a Christian. They must be doing something, right?
She doesn't beat the shit out of anybody.
Yes, exactly.
What does it feel like when your dad is doing procedures on brains? Like,
listen to the procedures, though. Brain surgeons and neurologists work hand in hand. Yeah. Brain surgeons get in the head.
Yeah.
They open up the head and they make the big bucks.
Yeah.
The neurologist consults.
He's the one who's figuring out what's saw going on in the head.
Parkinson's, MS, all these really, really hard diseases.
And did you understand as a kid that what he was doing at all? What did he bring home and explain to you at like 13 of what his days were like?
Zero.
Because he thought you couldn't handle it, maybe?
Probably, yeah. I mean, my dad would come home, I would say very late at night. I mean, he would come home 8, 9 o'clock at night for sure. And and so I feel like most of my childhood was spent with my mom. And the thing that I remember that was really, I recently started doing crossword puzzles. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because the New York Times crossword puzzle. And the reason I do it is my dad used to do it every day. So that's all you'd just see him as a thing. He'd read war novels and he'd do the crossword puzzle.
And it'd make you happy.
And he would just do it start to finish. And it was clearly some kind of therapeutic activity for him. And now that I do the crossword puzzle, I totally get it.
Because it calms you down? Does it calm you down?
Yeah.
But did you ever, like, say high school, 16, 17, were you ever aware of what he was treating and what he was dealing with?
So one time we had a thing in grade school called Science Club. And it was every Friday night, what nerds we were, Science Club.
Yeah.
And every Friday night. And then one night, he was the designated speaker. And he brought his tools, he got the medical toolkit, took out all the instruments, showed what they did. He brought like a brain, not a skull, but like a plastic brain and showed the different parts, the cerebellum and all the cortexes and things. And I just thought like, wow, my dad knows all this stuff. Like,
he never mentioned this to me.
I just thought he was like,
cortex? Yeah, he never says that.
I just thought he was really mad about stuff all the time.
He's stressed.
But then, that was a positive thing, Science Club. And then the other positive thing was, every now and then, someone would come up to me. I grew up in Shrewsbury, Mass, outside of Worcester, and a patient would come up and go, "Your dad is one of the best doctors, if not the best doctor I've ever seen in my entire life." And it was they were very moved by him. Mm-hmm. So I was like, "Okay, well, he must be doing good work. I don't know."
Yeah. And when you went to college, where were you at? You were at
Georgetown.
At Georgetown.
Yeah.
Did you enter Georgetown knowing you were going to go into something creative or writing or performing?
I went into Georgetown looking for sketch comedy.
Yeah.
Because I loved SNL. I made a movie
about
SNL.
Maybe love is not a strong enough word.
Obsessed.
Has Lorne Michaels ever acknowledged the movie?
No, but he's always very nice.
Yes.
Whenever I run into him, he's always very friendly, which is nice. Yeah. I have a great deal of respect for him and the institution.
Sure.
I mean, what's funny about it is like, it was like, I wanted to be a sketch comedian And in college, I did improv and stand-up and realized, oh, no, I'm a stand-up comedian.
Yeah.
And that's a weird thing.
But it is a, you know, it's a ballsy thing to say, I'm going to go to one of the finest universities in our country and
yes.
use it to become a sketch player.
It's absurd.
And especially at that time, I don't think people thought there was a lot of job opportunities. So if you didn't get on Saturday Night Live, what do you even think the sketch job is?
No, as a matter of fact, like I was studying screenwriting in college and I thought, I'm going to be a screenwriter. And then I got towards the end of college and I realized you can't go on monster.com and type in screenwriter. Nobody wants them. I mean, you dealt with this, I'm sure, where you're just going like, well, how do you make movies? And like, you know, Gary Shandling or, you know, gave you a shot to direct. If I'm not mistaken, it was his idea for you to direct.
Yeah, I would have never asked. And I didn't even want to write movies, I don't think. I just thought, there's no stand-up major.
Yeah.
So I studied screenwriting, but the opposite of you, I didn't think I was going to do it.
Yeah.
I just thought, I'll learn something that'll teach me something, but I was more into stand-up. And I loved Harold Ramis, so I was aware that there was some sort of writing, performing job
yeah.
that might exist. And I loved Woody Allen
yeah.
and Barry Levinson, so I don't know. I guess it wouldn't hurt to know this.
Yes.
But I didn't take it very seriously.
Yeah, and so studying screenwriting, and then at a certain point, I got a job working the door at the Washington, D.C. Improv Comedy Club, which is one of the best clubs in the country, which is, by the way, pure luck. I mean, the same way that, like, your mom worked at a comedy club, and so you got to see all these comics young, I worked at the door of a comedy club. It just so happened to be one of the best comedy clubs in America. It's just lucky.
But were you thinking you were going to do stand-up when you got that job, or you were still a sketch guy and this was a good way to make some money while working on that?
I wanted to see comedy. I couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember like first few weeks of college, I was like, I'm going to see some live comedy in Washington, D.C.
When's Milton Berle get to town?
So I went to see, I don't think I've ever told the story. I went to see Flip Orley, comic hypnotist. At the Washington, D.C.
I love the comic hypnotist.
It was brilliant. It was brilliant. I laughed so hard. It was so funny. And it's, of course, it's this great club, Washington, D.C. Improv. And I got the bill with all the drinks and everything. Like, it's like $95? Like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know what it was. It was so much money. I was like, this is all the money I have for the semester. I was like, okay, I'm never going to go to a comedy club again. Okay. So I didn't go to that comedy club for another year. And then there was the funniest person on campus contest. And I entered. Nick Kroll entered, who I didn't know at the time. Ten other people entered. I won. I'd never done stand-up. So one of the prizes was this big, giant check for $250. A huge check like this big. And then the chance to perform and open for someone at the Washington, D.C. Improv. So they said, we have this person coming, we have this person coming, we have Dave Chappelle coming. I was like, oh, Dave Chappelle, I love his stand-up. This is, of course, way before Chappelle's show. This is before the superstar.
This is when Chappelle's probably in his 20s.
This is, yeah, he was 24. Weeks before Half-Baked came out, actually.
So he's 24 years old, and you're 18
I'm like
or 19.
19. And I'm open for Dave, and which was a masterclass even when he was 24. You're going, oh my God. Yeah. This guy's like, this is genius.
What for that? Some people, the height.
Yeah.
Because he had young, crazy, hilarious, brilliant guy energy as a young man like Sandler when they're young.
Like Sandler.
And before
like Sandler.
They've seen and done so much, sometimes there's a hilarious aspect to it that you don't get to hold on to.
No. And it was beyond brilliant. And I just said to the club, I just begged them, like, please let me perform here again.
And how'd you do though?
I did okay. Yeah.
Second time doing stand-up.
Yeah, second time doing stand-up ever. And I was still doing characters.
Yeah. So you're like doing sketch as a stand-up. Give me one of the characters.
Oh my God. This is so painful. So the character that I was this guy from Boston, and it was, you know, Marty, like, my name's Marty Beckman, and I love partying, I love this. He's just leaning into the Boston accent. It's very, like, similar to, like, Fallon and Dratch doing those Boston accent characters. And I would just do that character for, like, 10 minutes, and it would kill. Like, it would do really well.
Yeah.
And then I started doing, I did like a seventh grade science teacher.
Well, Phoebe used to do that. He used to do the shop teacher.
Oh, is that right?
With the missing finger.
Mine was based on this eighth or ninth grade science teacher I had named Mr. Rutan, who people were so mean to, who was so nice, such a nice guy, and people used to throw pennies at his head and stuff like that. It was like awful. And I always thought like, that's an interesting character to play. Like, he'd be like, hello, welcome to class. Please stop throwing pennies at my head. Like, it was like ridiculous. And so I'd play these multiple characters. And then at a certain point I was like, I literally had this feeling of I'm not that good at these characters. Like, I know when people are good at characters. Yeah. I do improv. I was in the improv group at that point. And that's not me. But me talking in between the characters, that's pretty good.
It's funny how that happens for people, because there's a lot of singers that become comedians because their patter is funny.
Yes.
Or a magician who drops the tricks.
That's right.
Right?
The magician drops the tricks.
I mean, Toadie Fields was a singer.
Yeah.
And at some point, the patter was entertaining people more than the songs.
Yeah, so I used to do characters, and then I started doing like regular stand-up. And the big thing was, and this is similar to your experience in Long Island, is like getting to watch George Lopez and Margaret Cho and Jake Johansson and Brian Regan and Jim Gaffigan and Mitch Hedberg and Dave Attell. There's nothing that you could compare to that.
Yeah.
That's just the getting education. To see them.
Yeah. And also watching them do 6-7 shows over a weekend.
Yes.
And
yes.
Seeing really how they're doing it and watching the different performances and the way they change it up and where they're improvising, where they're not. You don't even know what you're learning. Your brain is just a supercomputer picking something up.
I always say this to aspiring comedians, is work at a comedy club. Get a job at a comedy club just so you can watch so many comedians. You know, there's so many clubs. There's like 20, 25 clubs, like Denver Comedy Works, or like, get a job. Just watch all those comics. You know, watch, I'm trying to think of who's coming through town. Watch Beth Stelling. Yeah.
Well, that's that's why.
Watch Atsuko Akatsuk. All these people, phenomenal.
I mean, that's why it's what's so funny about our stories being similar is I did that. But I was a dishwasher at a comedy club when I was 15 and realized I couldn't see the show because I was in the kitchen.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so I switched to busboy after like 4 months.
Yeah.
Because I was like, this plan isn't working because I'm in the kitchen.
I was a door person, and I'll tell you something funny about the door person. I've never told this story. There was another door person. I forget the guy's name. But what I realized at a certain point is that he was embezzling money from the club.
He had a scam. Everyone's got a scam in a restaurant.
Holy cow. I've never, other than like, I think I stole something from the pharmacy on my corner when I was like 10 years old and I got caught and I went back and apologized and my mom caught me. Other than that, I've never stolen anything. I'm like very like focused. I have a certain, I see things a certain way and I go, And this guy one day goes, if they show up late and they don't have tickets, you just get their money in cash and you put them at a table. So this guy was pocketing like $300-$400. And I was like, I'm not doing that. You're fucking crazy. Like, it's inconceivable that you'd be embezzling money from a club.
Yeah, well, we had a friend who did that at restaurants where he would toss the checks in the garbage when people paid in cash, because people used to pay in cash.
No way.
And then just, it was called check kiting, I think was the name.
Never even heard of that.
Yeah, and so they would maybe like once or twice a night, just keep the money from a table and toss the the bill before it was credit cards. And and there's so many ways to steal. We'll go over those later. And so you basically are doing stand-up, you graduate from school, you do a lot of improv at school with Kroll eventually.
Yep.
Gaffigan also.
Gaffigan's a different era. He's older. The 80s, from the 80s.
And so you're doing a stand-up group, and then school ends, right?
School ends.
And now it's like, I need to get a job. This has to pay now.
Yep.
Did it pay ever during college?
During college, so I would make about $50 a set, or $40, $50 a set. But I wasn't doing that many sets. I mean, if I was lucky, I'd get like 10, 15 sets a semester.
Yeah. And you went where when school ended to go, I'm going to be a comedian. Okay,
I'm going to New York City. I lived in my sister Gina's couch for a period of time. I lived with a roommate in Queens for a period of time. Then I lived with my girlfriend at the time.
Day job?
Day job was just temping at one of the places was Pfizer.
Mm-hmm. And they've done some good work.
They've done some good work. I did not do any of that work.
Their work lives in me.
That's right. It lives in me too. It's extraordinary. That company is amazing. The amount of dead wood at the bottom, which was what I was, is extraordinary. I mean, they have such deep pockets. They don't even know, I feel like, who they're paying after a while. Like I was
salespeople.
I was making like $14-15 an hour in the early 2000s doing like nothing.
But supposedly doing what?
Supposedly being an assistant to someone.
Who's doing something?
Who does something. Like literally, yeah. I can't even tell you to this day.
And so you're like doing spots in New York.
Yep. Till late at night. I was in the comic strip. The first club worker who gave me a shot was this guy, Lucian Hole.
Yeah.
Who passed away a bunch of years ago from an autoimmune disease. And he gave a lot of people their first breaks.
Sandler.
Rock. Well, maybe Eddie Murphy, although Eddie Murphy, I think, was successful by the time he got to there. I think Seinfeld, actually, Seinfeld was so successful that actually Seinfeld would, at the comic strip in, on the Upper East Side, where I was passed with Lucian, would decide whether comedians were passed and could work at the club. Did you ever hear that?
He would just say his opinion and that would be powerful.
He would audition them, apparently. That's what Lucian told me. Like a period of time in the 80s where Jerry Seinfeld would audition the comedians. Like what?
I'm sure he was tough.
He was tough and fair.
I mean, I remember one of the biggest moments in my young career was I was bringing on Jerry at the Improv and I just talked for a while before I brought him on. I just wanted him to see a couple of my jokes. And he got up on stage and went, that was funny.
Oh, that's nice.
And during really a time where I wasn't getting much done, that was fuel.
That's huge.
Because I knew he meant it, and I knew he wouldn't say it. Like, he seemed genuinely tickled by a couple of
things.
He's
impeccable with his word.
And so you started going on the road a little bit?
Lived by the four agreements. So then I started going on the road, yeah.
You're hosting.
I was hosting and middling. Yeah. I was essentially taking any work that would pay me $200 a week, essentially. Yeah. And I was keeping a very meticulous calendar of how many hundreds of dollars I was making each week, because I knew that I needed to make about $1,100 in a month.
Yeah.
To continue living in my
that's
my apartment in Queens. Yeah.
Like for me too,
$1,100.
My rent was $425.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I can make $800,
yeah.
I had food.
Yep.
I could pay for gas.
Yep.
And that was it. And that's kind of the fun part of a young comedian's life is if you have a couple of places that'll throw you a little cash and you're willing to live very cheaply.
Very cheaply, yeah.
You can have fun.
Yeah.
If the clubs will occasionally throw you a hamburger.
That's really funny. Yeah, I mean, so I was at the comic strip and then eventually Gotham Comedy Club, Caroline's. Caroline's was a big break because they have a kitchen. Yeah. So to speak to your thing about food, like you'd go like, oh my God, they give you a chicken sandwich?
Fettuccine Alfredo?
Forget about it. This is like luxury.
I remember the Improv, they throw me a fettuccine Alfredo at the end of the night.
Oh my gosh.
Every night I'd eat an entire fettuccine Alfredo. Sometimes I'd ask for double pasta in it. And then I'd go right to sleep. That fettuccine is still in my heart. And so when you were starting and you were doing jokes and at some point you realized that you were a storyteller.
Yeah, yeah.
When did that happen where you found what is your style? Because your style, you know how you know you're like one of the greats is because people can do an impression of you. Right. You know, like a smart person can do your cadence and, you have almost, and dare I say, like a Cosby-esque.
Oh, no.
Like, and I say that as if...
as though nothing happened in the last 40 years.
But if we could just talk in rhythms, and that you've created your own way of doing it, and that's really impossible to do. There's very few people, I think, who have found something where, like music, you go, oh, that's what that band sounds like.
Well, I think... So part of it is that I was asked to tell a story for The Moth when I was about 24 years old. And The Moth is this, of course, great storytelling series that now is like a popular public radio show and podcast. They have a book, et cetera, multiple books. But at the time, it was a storytelling series in New York. And they asked me to tell a story. And Catherine Burns coached me through this story that was very embarrassing that ended up in my girlfriend's boyfriend special about how when I was in high school, I had my first girlfriend and she told me not to tell anyone that I was her boyfriend. It's embarrassing telling it now still because she had another boyfriend, but he
didn't.
It's
kind of sexy.
Oh, God. It's terrible. And then it gets embarrassing because she invites me to meet her parents and I'm so excited and I meet her parents and then this other guy's there and I realize it's her boyfriend. And then he invites all of us to go to his house. I meet his parents and then the punchline of the whole thing is it's very nerve-wracking meeting your girlfriend's boyfriend's parents for the first time because part of you is angry and then part of you still wants to make a good impression.
How old is this? It's like high school senior?
So that was, high school senior, yeah.
I don't know if you're allowed to say this anymore, but that is like a very dirty young woman who liked to live a life of treachery.
She had a double life.
She was turned on by having it be insidious and semi-criminal, her sex life.
Her fake name in the story is Amanda. Her real name I will not say.
But it starts with an A. I know it does. I know you didn't go that far Andrea. We know it's Andrea.
No, I will not cast a judgment on her except to say.
I'm saying I'm in awe.
Yeah, yeah.
To be running two guys in senior year of high school.
Running two guys.
Didn't Charles Gerald have two families? You know, that's what she was doing.
Oh, my God. She was double family. For that. She had double family. So I tell that story. It was at Aspen Comedy Festival in, I want to say, 2003 for The Moth.
And she's at the show.
I've never spoken to her since.
Never?
It's very odd. No, and I've never, very rarely as an adult have I gone down the Facebook rabbit hole of like, where are these people? But one time I was like, why don't I look her up, see if she's around? Nothing. I Google her. Nothing. I'm like, oh, okay. I think she's gone from the universe for me.
No, she has a new last name. She's married.
Yeah, certainly.
She has a second family somewhere else.
Third or fourth
family. She somehow found a way to have children with both families and not get caught.
She has a fifth and sixth family. She's like that Inventing Anna character.
Yeah. But they were those kids like in high school. There were certain people that they really loved to cheat.
Yeah, no, it was pretty wild. Like the degree to which high school kids develop at a different rate is very funny.
Yeah. Well, that was what Paul Feig's whole thing about
Freaks and Geeks
with Freaks and Geeks was. Some kids wanted to grow up fast. Some kids didn't want to grow up and were like hanging on by their nails to stay children.
Oh, that's interesting.
And that's what he wrote. I found his original notes.
No kidding.
And I put some of it in the book page. But that's what he said. It was the difference between wanting to grow up faster or slower.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
And the geeks loved being kids.
Yes.
And everyone else was like trying to get in the world.
Oh, my gosh.
And so you realize after The Moth that you wrote a story really well. It's like having a teacher show you something.
Yeah.
And then you think, I got all sorts of stories. Did that hit you?
That's what it is. It was, I did the story, and then I go, okay, so this connection with this audience is deeper than what I'm doing normally. And what I'm doing normally is pretty good. I'd done Letterman. Like, I was doing pretty well. And so I was like, let me go down this rabbit hole. And then sort of the breakout story for me was the sleepwalking through a second story window story, because it was so Ira Glass, who eventually put it on This American Life, and that sort of broke me in that universe. He always says, like, it's the story that you can't follow in your own life.
Well, we only have so many great personal stories that happen to us.
Yes. Right?
And so that's just a...
Well, it's so on the nose as a metaphor. We're sleepwalking through our lives, and our lives are out of our own control, and all these different things about it that speak to like a larger truth about things. So I started telling that story, and that was back when Mulaney was at this point. I was doing a college tour for Comedy Central. I had just opened for like one of my first big breaks was I opened for Mitch Hedberg, Louis Black, and Dave Attell on the first ever Comedy Central live tour.
And you were the host.
I was the host on for like Philadelphia, DC, New York, Beacon Theater, which is wild. So like I just called the promoter and I just go like, I'll do it for free. And he's like, well, we can give you $75. And like they probably would have paid someone $1,000 to do it. I'm like, I'll do it for nothing. I just love these comics. I'll do anything to work with these comics.
I still do that. I mean, it doesn't mean as much.
Yes.
I don't need the $50 as much. But when I was young, I was always in a car driving 3 hours to see something or perform on something.
Yeah.
I never really cared about that as long as I could eat a little bit.
Yeah, the eating is key.
But to get in those situations where you think it's all about the experience. It's all about, I'm going to get to watch Mitch Hedberg every night.
Because I'm such a fan of comedy, I've never driven a hard bargain when it comes to getting to be around comedy I love.
And what, at that point, what was Hedberg like?
I mean, Hedberg was definitely on drugs. There was stuff going on with Mitch, and I sort of knew there was some drugs, and I would sort of just try to do my thing, which is, I'd be like, hey, let's play tennis. Let's go bowling, you know, like, and we would always sort of make plans, and I, you know, I've had other addict friends over the years, and he would sort of inevitably, like, break a lot of plans, which was always very sad to me.
Oh, sure. Terrible.
And so when he passed, it was devastating. Like everybody with addict friends, it's always devastating. You try and figure out what could I have done. And
well, I think we're a part of a breed of corny people.
Yeah, we're corny comics.
Like we're afraid of some of that stuff.
I've never used coke.
I've never used coke.
Yeah.
I'm way too
afraid of it.
I'm on stimulants. I'm on Vyvanse.
Clearly.
Get Vyvanse. Can I be the Vyvanse guy? Do I do commercials for Vyvanse?
Is that right?
I've never felt clearer with Vyvanse.
Oh my gosh.
And I'm able to fall asleep after an 8-hour lay down.
Oh my gosh.
So you realize that there were more stories to tell. And you were on the road when you had
when I had the incident of jumping through the window. So So when that happened a few months later, so by opening for Mitch Hedberg and Louis Black and Dave Attell, Comedy Central gave me my own like college tour. It was called the Medium Man on Campus Tour. And actually, Mulaney opened for me on the tour. We got a tour bus. It was so strange. We got this big tour bus. And on that tour, I literally still have the footage somewhere. I started telling the sleepwalking story. And immediately, it did pretty well.
Yeah.
Like, it was like, oh, this is, even though this story is crazy and really far out, like, this definitely works.
Yeah.
And that was like, gosh, 2004, 2005. And then I developed Sleepwalk With Me, this show, for about 4 years. Literally years of working with Seth Barish, my director. And then along the way, like Nathan Lane came to a show of mine at Caroline's one night, and I was doing the material from what became Sleepwalk With Me. And he and I became friends, and I said, I want to do this as a theater show. And he said he would consider presenting it, you know, putting his name on it.
Did you ever have anybody from the theater helping you know how to write a piece like that?
Only pretty much my screenwriting and playwriting professor, John Glavin, and who suggested I write a solo show, by the way.
Yeah.
So he was my screenwriting professor, and I would talk to him maybe once a year, once every 2 years after college. And at one point he just goes, I think you just have to write a solo play because there's no budget. You know, it's basically free if you can get a stage. You know how to write a play. And so I wrote Sleepwalk With Me and brought it to Seth Barish. And Seth Barish helped me kind of hone it into what became Sleepwalk With Me. And then Nathan Lane presented it, which completely, in hindsight, changed my career entirely.
Someone credible anointed you.
Yes.
And you need the professor to say, this is the road you go down, because if not, you're just going to turn it into your new stand-up set.
That's right.
And then you need a professional actor legend to say, this is worth paying attention to, and then you do the work. But also, I've always found that most people don't do that work. I mean, there were people who did one-person shows, but you're really putting years the way someone writes a play into these
literally
pieces.
Years, yeah.
And it requires an ability to stay focused and not lose your sense of what you're doing over many years. It's like writing Hamilton. You have to not lose touch with what interested you about it. And because you craft it line by line, you're every night, it's like you're testing every bit of it. And I think that is why there really aren't that many people. I mean, other than you and Colin Quinn, there's not a lot of people really busting out these types of performances.
There's Hasan Minhaj.
Yes, yeah.
Hannah Gadsby. There's only like a few people who are working in the space of like, and right now Alex Edelman, mm-hmm. who I'm presenting his show, are working in this space of what some people call like an Edinburgh show.
And what can you accomplish in that format that you can't when you're just doing a comedy club or a theater as a comedian?
I ask myself every day.
It's lonelier in a way.
It is lonelier because it's a longer track.
Yeah.
It takes so long. You know, like I'm in the middle of writing The Old Man and the Pool right now. I was just at Berkeley Rep. I'm at Steppenwolf in May. I'm at Mark Taper Forum in the month of August. And then hopefully it'll go to Broadway. Hopefully. It takes years and years and years. And like you said, like you have to stay focused on, in this case, this is a show about life, death, mortality. And, the idea that we're, the phrase, I'm 43 now, and the phrase for middle age is over the hill. And I never understood the phrase till I got on the hill. Yeah. And I'm looking around, I'm going, oh, there's natural causes, there's diabetes. And it's like, it's wild. And I'm trying to, as best as possible in the show, bring people into my shoes regardless of what age they are.
Yeah, and make it enjoyable to think about the big stuff.
Yeah.
And not a depressing night.
It's not depressing at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's the trick of it, which is let's go to the place that we're not always comfortable going.
Yes.
And we'll connect and we'll laugh and we'll exchange our feelings about this.
Yeah, not only that, this is and part of this, by the way, part of it, look, there's a lot of people I work with. I work with my brother Joe, I work with Seth, I work with my wife Jen, I work with Peter. But a lot of it is who you they say it's who you know, but it's also like who you insist on knowing. I feel like you and I are friends from over the years, and it's like you've given notes on this show that are directly in the show. Mm-hmm. And a lot of
they better be.
I think you do too. It's like, I ask my smartest friends, smartest people I know, what their honest feelings are about my work. And I'm ready to take it.
And there's nothing more fun than helping someone, or at least saying, well, here's what I make of it, or here's what I might do. Because when you see someone else's show, you get inspired, but then you don't have to be responsible
for anything you say. Yeah.
Like someone said that's what they thought Shanling loved about mentoring people or giving advice, because you don't have that pressure of, I'm going to bomb with it.
Yes.
So sometimes those people can crack it because they don't have that stress or that inner critic, and they can just see it.
There was someone relayed a thing that Alan Zweibel said recently, which I thought was great. And I love Alan, is how can people become jerks in comedy sometimes? Because they lose their sense of wonder.
I think that's true. I have that always, because I do feel like I never know if anything will work.
Yeah.
You don't know.
Nobody knows.
And you don't know, like, how do you judge it? It's like the bubble comes out, and there certainly was some critics that were rough on it, and the crowd seems to really be loving it. And you go, what does that mean? And I went back and I read like the cable guy reviews.
Oh, yeah,
now,
yeah.
Looking back
I
now.
I love the cable guy so much.
Like, I don't meet anyone on earth who doesn't like the cable guy.
That's so funny.
In 2022. I read the review. I mean, it literally was like, we were mean-spirited.
Oh my gosh,
and,
really?
And Jim is menacing.
Oh my gosh.
And they're talking about each scene that's like the classic scene, like him doing karaoke, as if it's an example of the worst scene ever.
Oh my gosh, no.
And as a person now, I have to go, I've been through this so many times. There's so many things that I've liked. Some of them were loved by the critics and made no money, and then the crowd found them later.
Yeah.
Some of the critics hated and the crowd found it instantly.
Yeah.
And then slowly you get this bounce back of, oh, looking back, we like that one.
Yeah.
Like Heavyweights, everyone shit on Heavyweights.
Oh my God, that's hilarious.
And I only hear from people like, I watched that 40 times as a kid. And sometimes maybe I'm wrong. Like I'll never know. I never watched the movie clean.
Right.
I've been thinking about it for years, so I'll never watch it with the way a person sees a movie that they've never seen. So I'm just guessing it's good.
So we have a question from Alon first. So Alon, if you could come on stage.
Hi, Mike. Hi, John. My question is, when you're having a rough day of writing, how do you get through it without depleting your self-esteem?
Oh, wow.
How do you get through a rough day of writing? How do you?
That's a great question. I mean, it's nearly impossible for me to separate the two things. I would say, and because I don't have... I think it's just tactics, right? Like, I think you and I both have a similar tactic, which is go for a walk, try to go out and try to grab some sunshine.
Or stop writing. Give it up. Didn't happen today.
Leave some ink in the pen, as Hemingway says.
Sometimes what I'll do when the day is terrible, if I'm not stopping, I'll just open up a document and I will just babble. Anything that comes to my head, because I always think that things just bubble up and you don't know why, but there's a reason why, but you don't know.
Yes.
And I'll just start writing, free writing. And you could do a thing where you just say, I'm not going to stop typing for 10 minutes.
Yep.
And there's always something good in it. And that could end the session. And maybe there's
some
one
people call
thing
that timed writing.
Yes.
A timed writing, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, you set a timer. You put your stuff on airplane mode and you just write whatever is in your brain. And I do the same thing. And I find it to be wildly therapeutic. And actually, I've written some of my best lines over the years from those timed writings. Because sometimes it's like you write out, you accidentally spill your guts on the page.
Yeah. You just let... And wherever it will go.
Yes.
Sometimes in the morning I do that. The second I wake up, I start writing.
Yes.
Like this morning, I was like, okay, I'm on Seth Meyers. Hey, Judd, how are you doing? I'm doing great. Oh, what have you been up to? And I just start answering the questions I think he's going to ask me as if we're there.
Oh my gosh.
And I was like, oh, I have this
new
book.
He's the king of comedy.
Sicker in the head. And then he's like, well, I'm not in it. And I remembered he wasn't in it. And I felt bad because he's a genius. Why shouldn't he be in it? And then I said, can I interview you now? And then I just wrote down that his answer would be, sure. And then I would say, what's your trauma?
Oh my gosh.
And then his response was, and he didn't do this joke. I wanted him to say, actually, I had no trauma as a child. And I was supposed to respond, well, that's why I don't want you in the book, because you're so damn boring.
Oh my gosh.
But he said on the show when I said, what's your trauma?
Yes.
He said, I don't want to be in your book.
I don't want to be in your book. So just for the podcast listeners, if you're interested in getting sicker in the head and you need one thing, one more sales pitch to put you over the top, it includes interviews with Amber Ruffin, Bowen Yang, Cameron Crowe, David Letterman, Ed Templeton, Gary Goldman, Gail King, George Shapiro, Hannah Gadsby, Hasan Minhaj, Jeff Tweedy, Jimmy Kimmel, John Candy,
this is going to take way
John
too
Cleese,
long.
John Mulaney, Kevin Hart, Lin-Manuel Miranda,
John
Lulu
Candy
Wang,
from 1984.
Yes. Margaret Cho, Mindy Kaling, Mort Saul, Nathan Fielder, Pete Davidson, Rami Youssef, Roger Daltrey, Sacha Baron Cohen, Samantha Bee, Tig Notaro, Whitney Cummings, Whoopi Goldberg, and Will Ferrell. And if that doesn't sell you on a book, I don't know what does.
there's a great John Cleese interview there where he just talks about how to be creative, like how to get your brain going.
Wow.
So that would be the best answer is in the book, read the John Cleese chapter.
Yes.
Because he explains it. But I always have a very simple theories of writing. Down up theory, get it down.
Yep.
Then fix it up. So you give yourself permission to suck. Anything, just get something down.
Yes.
And
so
then
true.
In a different session on another day, go into fix up mode.
That's nice.
The main thing. Who's next? Do we got someone else?
Yeah, let's go to the next question.
So coming up next, we have Julian. So if Julian could join us on stage.
Hey, guys. This is kind of a depressing question, but was there ever a moment where you didn't think it was going to work out in comedy? And if so, when was like the first moment maybe that fear went away and you kind of felt safe and comfortable where you were at?
It's a great question, Julian. It's, I never thought there was any way to fail because my bar for success was so low. So when I worked at the Washington DC Improv at the door and I was watching free comedy shows, I was like, I've made it.
Yeah, I think that's helpful. I never had a mega success dream. My dream was that the other comedians would think I belonged, which I think is still how I generally feel.
Oh, that's like, interesting.
If I could hang out at a comedy club and be respected,
yes,
and do my thing in the same world that they did their thing,
yeah,
that was mainly the goal, to just be in it.
Yes.
To be in the game with people. And I think that's probably a lot of what always drives me.
Yeah.
If I'm doing any stand-up, I want it to be that if someone watches me in the back of the room, they would feel like I was doing something respectable.
Yes.
And so, you know, when people say, oh, I liked your set, or that's very meaningful to me because that's most of the dream right
yes.
there. And then with movies, it's a similar thing. If you make a movie and then another filmmaker says, I like it, that's kind of almost more than my own self-esteem, which is bad because you do have to have your own internal compass for if you think you're doing good work or bad work. But as a young fanboy comedy nerd, that was always a driver. And I think that there's always a moment where you think you're not good enough. I mean, I've had that over and over again, certainly in early days where you're aware that the people around you are so much better than you.
Yeah.
But I always thought this takes a long time. And so I gave myself a long timeline.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought, well, it takes like 7 years to figure this out.
Yeah.
So even when I was bad year three, or at least not that good, I just thought, well, got 4 more years to get there.
That's interesting.
And that was usually what was in my head.
Yeah. Yeah, I was talking to Atsuko Akatsuka on the podcast about this exact thing, which is, we were talking about how long does it take to become yourself on stage, essentially. And like the best theories I've heard are 10 years.
Yeah.
Atsuko was saying she's at year 11. She thinks it was about year 10-ish too.
I can even feel it now. I started doing stand-up again after like a 20-year break 7 years ago.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm probably just now on the verge of figuring it out.
Yeah.
Which means I feel bad for everyone who's paid to see me. Oh my the last gosh. Bunch of years.
part of it too, like to answer the question too, is like part of it's about creating your own community. Like when I was in college, like I like hung out with my improv group all the time. You know, when I got out of college, like, with you know Nick and I and our friends Brian and Ed, and we're and Conrad had this group called Little Man, and we performed all the time. And we weren't very successful. But we had a nice time. We had a great time together. We had a lot of laughs, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, I will say like, you know, the laughs I had then, laughs I have now, it's the same thing that you're striving for, which is like a community. It could be a community of 5 people, 10 people who you like to hang out with and do comedy with.
Next question.
Norman will be next. So Norman, if you could join us.
Hey, Judd, Mike.
Hello.
Thanks again for doing this, guys. Appreciate it. Just kind of wanted to touch on this because I know you guys are kind of masters of observational comedy. And for me, that's kind of what's driven my whole storytelling sensibilities and what got me into comedy writing, obviously. But I just want to know, like, you know, what would you say is the key to preserving that almost observational eye that you guys have held across all your projects that, you know, makes your work stay this untouchable for this long?
How do you keep your observational eye? Well, I try to think of it in these terms, and it usually simplifies it for me. I think a lot about Buddhism, that life is suffering, yet we soldier on.
Yeah.
And everyone is trying to make their life work. And the thing that makes us laugh is talking to each other about how it's going. And what are you doing to make it work? And all the ways it's not working kind of makes us laugh because it's so human and funny the way we stumble as we're figuring stuff out. We're all in the process of evolving and learning.
Yeah.
And the lessons are funny. The beatings we take that give us a lesson make us laugh as long as it's not cruel or you make no progress.
Right. Our high school girlfriend having another boyfriend is funny because we've all had something like it.
Jumping out the window.
Jumping through a second you have an affliction.
It is. It's funny because you're trying to handle it. How do I make my world work in spite of it? What does it mean? How do I interpret this? How will I live? How will I have a girlfriend? How will I have a family? You know, you root for that person just the way you root for anyone just trying to make their life work. And so for me, at some point I thought, no matter, if you get more specific, it becomes more universal. Even if the specific isn't the same thing other people have, on some level, they do feel like the person jumping out the window. They have their version of it. And that's what I'm generally observing. So if I'm making This Is 40 and Paul Rudd is hiding in the bathroom on his iPad, just avoiding the family, trying to get a break.
Yeah.
I'm observing that of myself. And then the thing that people relate to, because that's like a weird thing that everyone related to because it was earlier in technology.
Yeah.
Of the way we make our little escapes to get a second, because we're all trying so hard to do right by everybody, but we're also we feel like we're taking a beating and failing so much that we're all hiding in the bathroom in some respect.
Yeah, like Ira Glass is one of the best observationalists I know personally, and I think it's partly because he interviews so many people for his show. He's constantly carrying a shotgun microphone around the country and going, "Hey, how do you feel about this or whatever?" And he's just a big listener. He asks a lot of questions. Like people who ask more questions than they answer generally are pretty good observationalists.
And people are weird.
People are weird.
If you pay any attention to anyone, it's all there.
Yeah, it's all there.
It's just
it's all there.
What Gary Shandling was talking about was that people wear a mask and they have the way they want to be seen, which is very different than who they are inside.
Yes.
And so we're all saying, oh, I'm comedy guy. I'm doing well. And then if you follow me out of the room, you see what it really is.
Yes.
And that's where the comedy comes from. And if you observe anyone, you notice there's the truth and then there's the mask.
Yeah. Write it all down.
Write it up. That's what I always say to people.
Write it up,
That's a great idea. Write it up! Most people don't write it up. You gotta write it up.
Well, you've had a really interesting experience over the years with, like, Amy Schumer, for example, where
she wrote it up.
Yeah, she wrote it up. So, like, so you heard her on Stern, and she's talking about some of these really interesting stories about her life, and you sort of called her and were like, this is a movie. Yeah. Let's make this as a movie. And she wrote it up.
I mean, that's it. Is that there was a moment where we talked about what the movie could be, and we talked about, you know, some of the beats. And then she just sent me 20 pages.
Yeah.
And they were good.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of it's in the movie.
Yeah.
And I just went, oh, she can really do this. She,
yeah.
Because you don't know. So you read something with tons of people. You're waiting to see, can they translate these thoughts and feelings onto the page?
Yes.
So how do you know when your show is done, the one you're working on now?
Yeah.
Because the themes are very deep.
Yeah.
How do you know when you are getting close to having it, or at least maybe the main ideas have landed?
It's funny because with every show, it's different. When I know it's done is like I tour, you know, I'm in the middle of touring 50 cities right now. And when I start to get to a point where when we cut to black and the lights come up, I can just see in the audience's face that there's an experience that's happened. Mm-hmm. And I go, okay, we're close.
Yeah,
I can keep refining this and I can keep making this punchline better and blah, blah, blah. But fundamentally, this story, that's what this is.
Yeah. But do you ever get bored of doing the show? Do you ever think to yourself, I don't know if I could do keep saying this for another year or two?
I don't get bored of the show. Although, you know, what's funny is like, you know, I do some performances for my audience, like the other night in Dallas. And, you know, I've done shows in Denver and Seattle and everything. And those are for my audience. And then every now and then I'll get booked at like, you know, a college or a corporate event or something that's not my audience. And it's just sort of general everybody yeah. who got invited to that event. And then I really see what the show is.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, how does this hold up under the stress test of these people do not know who you are. They do not care. Mm-hmm. And those shows teach me the most
yeah.
about what the show is. Because I go, okay, when it's not the audience that, you know, when people buy a ticket, they're invested in the show being pretty good.
Yeah.
But when they didn't buy a ticket, that's when you know if you have something or not. All right, so we're gonna wrap up. But thanks for joining us on the celebration. Sicker in the Head.
It's all for charity for 826 for free tutoring and literacy programs for kids in different programs around the country that 826 runs that Dave Eggers started that organization. My grammar was so bad in explaining the literacy program there. I like said everything like backwards. So I need.
I'd say I think that the only proper way to describe a literacy program yeah.
is with really bad grammar. But anyway, all the money goes to them. But thank you for doing this, Mike.
Thanks for having me.
I could do it for 5 hours more. I feel I'm just scratching the surface. I was frustrated 40 minutes in with my time restraint.
Working it out, because it's not done. We're working it out, because there's no one. That's going to do it for another episode of Working It Out with Judd Apatow. He is phenomenal. His book is phenomenal. It's called Sicker in the Head. We want to thank Penguin Random House for setting this whole thing up. You can follow Judd at Judd Apatow. You could follow him on Instagram at Judd Apatow. You can follow him on Twitter at Judd Apatow. You can watch his movies wherever there are movies. You can watch his television shows wherever there are television shows. Our producers are working it out are myself, along with Peter Salamone and Joseph Berbiglia, consulting producer Seth Barish, sound mix by Kate Belinsky, associate producer Mabel Lewis. Special thanks to my consigliere, Mike Berkowitz, as well as Marissa Hurwitz and Josh Upfall. As always, a very special thanks to my wife, the poet J. Hope Stein. Great news about our book. Our book is called The New One, and it is a finalist for the Thurber Prize for American Humor. We couldn't be more honored. It is a big labor of love. We appreciate you reading it and listening to the audiobook. The Thurber House is in Columbus, Ohio. It's a phenomenal museum. It's just, I couldn't recommend it more highly. As always, a special thanks to Jack Antonoff and Bleachers for their music. They are on tour now. They're going everywhere. They're going to London right around when I'm going to London. So you could, you know, go one night to Bleachers, one night to Berbiglia. As always, a special thanks to my daughter, Una, who helped create a radio fort made of pillows. Thanks most of all to you who are listening. Tell your friends, and thank you for also telling your enemies. They need to know. We're working it out. We'll see you next time, everybody.